Hello and welcome to the Badger Talks podcast, the podcast that shares interviews with experts from the University of Wisconsin-Madison community about their work, research, and a little bit about what they're like as people too. I'm your host, Buzz Kemper. Today we'll be talking about the coexistence of carnivorous wildlife and humans, what works and what doesn't, and I'm happy to have as my guest Dr. Adrian Trevis, Professor of Environmental Studies and the founder and director of the Carnivore Coexistence Lab at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Adrian, thank you so much for doing this. This is a really fascinating topic to me. I'm an outdoor guy, and I'm really interested in the subject. So you are the creator of the Coexistence Lab for coexistence between carnivores and humans. So let's start with that, because to a carnivore, we are food. So right away, there's a little potential conflict there.
Yeah, and thanks for having me. Can I call you Buzz?
Buzz, of course.
It's fine,
yes.
Great.
All Thank right. you so much.
Thanks for inviting me, Buzz. So actually, most carnivores are not evolved to eat people.
Okay.
So they don't so much look at us as a snack, although obviously it can happen in rare cases. What we do more often in the Carnivore Coexistence Lab is understand how people and large carnivores can live together with minimal conflict, with minimal killing, which is usually the killing of domestic animals like livestock or house pets by large carnivores, which, by which I include my lab studies, tigers in the Russian Far East, big cats in Africa, hyenas in Africa, but wolves and bears in North America. So, you know, we work on all the large carnivores. That's the members of the mammalian carnivore.
So that's I'm glad you said that, because I was going to ask you if you concentrate on a specific geographical area, or if you're studying carnivore and human existence all over the world.
Yeah, globally, wherever we can.
That's so big.
It's a little too big.
Yeah,
you're right.
How do you do that?
We do our best with a few pilot studies, a few model studies, and then we write about them for the international community. So we're not actually working everywhere. We've had projects in 7 different countries, including the U.S. and Canada. But we basically focus in on a particular problem of coexistence, such as the problem that many domestic animal owners have in coexisting with wolves in minimal conflict. Like, traditionally, farmers with livestock would kill wolves on suspicion that they might attack their domestic animals, right? And working with a team from 5 different countries, from Israel, Slovakia, Slovenia, the U.S., we've actually shown that killing wolves to protect domestic animals doesn't work most of the time. And sometimes it has the opposite effect of raising the risk for livestock, making wolves attack more livestock than in the past. Mm-hmm. So we're continuously trying to answer these questions, such as, is lethal management an effective intervention, so that we can address what are often just assumptions. Like, in traditions, right, wolves were killed to protect livestock.
Yeah.
But did it actually work? We don't know. It's just an assumption. So we're continuously asking and answering those kinds of questions.
I'm really glad to hear that just trying to wipe out the wolves doesn't work, because I'm not a fan of that. But why it's counterintuitive. Why doesn't it work?
Okay, so what goes on in most lethal management is really far from the site where, say, a wolf killed a calf. Mm-hmm. Very far from the site, long after the event, the government agents come in and they put down some traps, or they sit and wait and shoot the first wolf they see. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that that kind of lethal management typically doesn't work. Sometimes it does, rarely. And equally often, it has the opposite effect. So what's going on here is that when people think about lethal management, they imagine the jaws of the wolf about to snap down on the neck of a calf or a sheep.
Yeah.
But that's not how lethal management's conducted. Granted, you can protect your sheep or calf if you catch a wolf in the act. But virtually no one ever catches them in the act. It happens at night. Mm-hmm. Most people are not watching their animals. Or if they do see a wolf coming close to livestock, they don't have a rifle handy. So what happens instead is government agents come in late. I'm not criticizing them for that. They have to respond, you know, after some interval.
Right. They can't be there in two minutes.
All the time. And they put traps and they lay in wait to shoot the wolf that they see, assuming it's a culprit or assuming any dead wolf, you know, is a good wolf.
Yeah, right.
And it turns out that's not the case. So one reason it might not be the case is that wolves are a team. They live in a pack, which is a family. It's generally all related wolves. Sometimes there's one, like, unrelated wolf in the pack. But they're a team. Mm-hmm. They're a team for defending their territory. They're a team for raising the pups together. And they're a team for hunting. And if you shoot just a random member of the team doesn't function as well. Just like with our athletic teams, you remove a critical member of the team, it just doesn't function as well. They're not going to win as many games. And when that wolf team starts to fail, right, they don't succeed at hunting, they start to scatter, break apart, and some of the members of that pack are actually going to look for the easiest food they can find out of hunger.
Yeah.
And livestock,
a fenced-in calf is just...
It's the easiest.
Just a snack. Yeah.
It's because it's predictable.
Yeah.
You don't have to search for it for very long, and it's not often well-defended.
Right.
So that seems to be explaining why you get this this elevated risk for domestic animals after a wolf or two is killed. Now, there have been just a few studies where they tried to eliminate the whole pack, right? Getting at the idea that if you get rid of the whole team of wolves, then you've solved your problem. However, neighboring packs come in and the same problems appear. The neighboring pack doesn't quite know the habitat as well as the original pack did. Mm-hmm. And as they're exploring, they find livestock in these predictable, large concentrations of animals that aren't very, they're not used to being hunted. So they're not very good at self-defense.
And what are the, so now we know one of the things that does not work. What are the things that do work in this classic situation? I know that there are many situations. It could be someone's pet dog that, you know, runs around in the backyard and gets picked off by a coyote. It could be, you know, a calf. But let's stick with domesticated farm animals and something like wolves. What are the kinds of things that we know do work?
So 100% right, Buzz. And the irony here is that all of these methods I'm about to describe are also traditional and ancient. Yeah. For instance, herding, using livestock guarding dogs to protect domestic animals. Those are two of the most effective defenses. So human herding and these special breeds of dogs, like you may have heard of the Anatolian Shepherd or the Maremma. These are special breeds of dogs, not your average dog, because they bond with livestock. They live with the livestock, not with the human family. Very different kind of breed of dog.
Oh, interesting. And no, I was not aware of these.
Yeah,
that's fascinating.
So these are like ancient, developed in Europe and the Near East to protect livestock.
Right, and they won't eat the livestock. They are there to protect it.
When well-trained and well-cared for.
That's really, really cool.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so these ancient means of protecting livestock proved to be very effective. Now, we also have a handful of sort of fancier, more innovative, technically ingenious solutions. Such as spiked collars on cattle, painting eye spots on the rump of cattle. These things help against things like leopards and lions. For wolves, we're finding more evidence for the human presence or those livestock guarding dogs.
I got to follow up on that. Is it that these leopards and lions just have poor eyesight and they see that as a face, or is it just that they don't process? I mean, how does that?
We don't know.
It seems odd that could fool.
Yeah, you know, the scientists who published this themselves admit that this seems strange, and they admit they don't know. This is a team out in working in southern Africa with lions and leopards attacking cattle. But the leading hypothesis is that the eye spots painted on the rumps of cattle suggest to the lion that the lion has been detected. And lions and leopards are what's called ambush stalking predators.
Right,
they rely on being not detected until they're close enough to attack.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
we seem
yeah,
to
anyone
be sort
who
of...
has an outdoor house cat has seen that. They
exactly.
they crouch in the weeds and then they spring. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Even some dogs will stalk and
right.
And if you catch them and make eye contact with them, they'll pretend like, oh, I wasn't doing anything.
Yeah, no, just yeah, yeah. just no, just checking out this tree over
yeah,
here.
Yeah. Exactly. yeah. So, you know, there's about half a dozen of these non-lethal methods of protecting okay. domestic animals from around the world. They've been developed often by folks who've been herding for generations. Sometimes there are these rather ingenious new inventions like solar-powered lights. But basically, we're finding that a lot of those non-lethal methods are effective, and they're proven effective using the highest standard of scientific evidence, okay. which is the randomized controlled trial. So, you know, when COVID hit, just for one example, the vaccines had to undergo a randomized controlled trial. That right. means half your subjects are randomly assigned to a placebo, right? No treatment.
Mm-hmm.
The other half are randomly assigned to get the therapy or the vaccine.
Mm-hmm.
And then you follow the two sets of patients over time. That is the same standard that is now being used in predator control around the world.
Okay.
Basically, you divide all your herds. Let's say I have 50 herds. 25 of them will be randomly assigned to a placebo control,
okay.
basically no effective defense.
Okay.
And
so
the
in this
other
case,
half,
a placebo control is just no control.
Well, it can
or,
be.
Or, oh, it can be.
It can
okay.
be the device is turned off, or
oh, okay, okay,
or the guards don't do anything.
Okay,
right? They are ineffective.
Okay,
and the other half are given this experimental therapy,
okay.
the treatment. Yeah. So that's the standard for evidence.
That is so fascinating. I wish I've got 30 more questions, but let's
go for it.
I won't keep you here all day, I promise. Let's talk a little bit about the pseudoscience side of this. So this was something that you mentioned to me before we turned on the recording, and I was really interested in that because we are used to hearing false information about vaccines or about climate change or, you know, whatever it might be, that there are 10,000 scientists who all say that X is true, and somebody watches a YouTube video and go, aha, this guy's got the real truth. And I did not think of something like that as occurring in the wildlife realm, but according to you, it does.
Yeah, it certainly does. And let me just make clear here that sometimes somebody will find something effective for their own farm,
right.
their own property. It really works for them, and they have reams of experience. Maybe they even have, or years of experience, maybe they even have reams of data to prove it for mm-hmm. their farm.
Mm-hmm.
Now, does that mean that their neighbor should adopt that? Not necessarily, because
yeah.
there's going to be subtle differences farm to farm to farm. Just like when, let's say, take chiropractic, if you have back pain, people might swear by it, but it might not be the right thing for you, Buzz.
Right.
So what science does is it looks across the range of farms. Hopefully you get a large sample of farms, and when we find evidence for the effectiveness, it's usually that more than half of the farms or above average numbers of the farms are benefiting from whatever the treatment is, right?
Mm-hmm.
Rather than one person being a real ambassador for their favorite method. So when we talk about pseudoscience in my field, it's often when the government grabs an anecdote like chiropractors work for back pain and protect domestic animals, right? I'm just making mm-hmm. something up here.
Right.
The
right.
government seizes on it and decides to invest huge amounts and spread it across the landscape for every farmer.
Mm-hmm.
That's the approach that concerns me. That's where sort of fake news and anecdotes become fact.
Right.
And scientists are in the best position to evaluate facts.
Mm-hmm.
So when I talk about the standard of evidence being the randomized controlled trial, that's because it protects against the normal human bias of really wanting the treatment to work.
Yeah.
And then advocating for it when we get a little glimmer of success.
Right.
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 So the randomized controlled trial takes it out of the hands of subjective human bias and mm-hmm. instead relies on this random assignment to treatment and control, looks
right.
at the outcomes, and only recommends a method after the randomized control trial is completed. Let me give you an example.
Sure.
So I was working with Dr. Omar Orens in Chile, in the country of Chile, where we were testing what are called fox lights. They're these solar-powered lights that turn on at night. They move around. They're random shifting lights. And it's believed that that actually was invented by an Australian sheep producer, sheep farmer, who believed it scared away foxes. So he called it fox lights.
Okay.
The odd thing we discovered in Chile was those lights, after doing an RCT, those lights seem to attract Chilean foxes to the lights, which is disastrous for a farmer, right?
Yeah, of course.
But the fox lights scared away pumas. So we, by doing an RCT...
So interesting.
Yeah.
To know the evolutionary explanation for that. Why do pumas feel repelled and foxes are like moths?
Love to know it too. We so rarely know the causes, especially in animal behavior.
Yeah.
But because of thanks to the RCT, we were able to tell people, don't use this as a protection against foxes in Chile, but it may work against pumas in Chile.
Yeah.
We're always cautious, right? It may work.
It may work. Yeah.
And right now the hypothesis is that the foxes are used to coming to lights because people use lights around their houses and you find scraps and garbage.
Right.
Pumas have not evolved that in Chile. They're not that used to people being around and using lights, so they fled from our lights.
Okay.
But without the RCT, we might have been in the position of saying the wrong thing about foxes or the right thing about one of the species and then generalizing to both of them incorrectly.
Yeah, that's just amazing. Yeah, so you have to overcome, with the pseudoscience stuff, you have to overcome confirmation bias, just
exactly.
like probably any other scientist has to do. What you want to be the case may not actually be the case, and so we have to look at it objectively and get the actual data. Yeah.
That's right. I'm glad you used the phrase confirmation bias because it's huge in my field and probably in a lot of fields of science where scientists themselves really want to find a result, and that can lead to confirmation bias. Mm-hmm. And randomization takes it out of our hands. You know, we literally roll dice to assign herds to the treatment or the control. Mm-hmm. And we've actually, my lab has actually pioneered what's called a crossover design, where a herd of livestock starts out in the control condition, and then midway through, we flip it into the treatment condition. Mm-hmm. And every herd that started in treatment gets flipped over into the control condition. Mm-hmm. So we're actually looking at the change in risk for herds as we take away the treatment or we give the treatment. Confirmation bias is huge in lethal management, partly because when humans kill something, They see the dead animal there and they think, okay, that's effective. I did something.
Yeah.
But if that animal is not a culprit, you may actually have created space for the real culprits, so they're going to have an easier time.
Yeah.
And what every single study of carnivores and livestock around the world has shown is that some carnivores are problematic and others are not, and they never will be.
Okay.
So if you're killing the wrong animal, you may be actually doing a counterproductive
exacerbating
thing.
Exacerbating the problem. Yeah. So fascinating. Yeah. And you partially answered this question with the pumas and the foxes in the Chilean situation, but I'm going to ask it anyway, just because in the broader sense of all this, because you're looking at carnivores and humans all over the world, if we made a Venn diagram between pumas in Chile and foxes or wolves here or, you know, any other, are there commonalities between the both either the problems and or the solutions, or are we in pretty much totally unique situations in different parts of the world?
No, I think your gut instinct's right there, Buzz. There are commonalities. For one thing, humans are humans.
Okay.
And secondly, the kinds of domestic animals we're talking about, it's basically sheep and cattle. Occasionally, there's some horses, mules, and donkeys mixed in, occasional poultry. But, you know, it's a handful of domestic animal species. And carnivores, largely, they break down into three categories of hunting styles. Mm-hmm. And so around the world, when I go to a new place, like for instance, I just got back from Zimbabwe and saw a species of carnivore I'd never seen before, the African wild dog, or sometimes called the painted dog. Oh. And when I asked questions about conflicts people had with the dogs, it was entirely predictable from what I'd learned about coyotes and wolves.
Interesting.
So it's distantly related, like super distantly, a couple million years, as I understand it.
Yeah.
And yet we find these commonalities. So people are people. Carnivores are, you know, just variations on a theme.
Mm-hmm.
domestic animals or variations on a theme. And what's stunning is when somebody in Uganda, for instance, uses a phrase the same way as a Wisconsin rancher did or farmer did, and they've never met. They've never talked to each other. We discovered this when we left Uganda after our PhDs, my wife and I, and started work on wolves in Wisconsin. In Uganda, the farmers were saying, the government's animals, the elephants, are damaging our crops.
Yeah.
Turn to a Wisconsin farmer. He says, the government's predators, the wolves, are causing me problems.
Okay.
We're like, people are people.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, no kidding. Wow. I suppose it's a little, it's got to be a little bit different dealing with wolves as opposed to elephants, but it's good news for you and people like you who are doing this research. I would imagine it's good news that there are commonalities because you don't have to reinvent the wheel each time you look into a situation.
100%.
There are going to be base level things that you know are true, and then you can build from there.
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, as a result, the field has advanced a lot just in my lifetime. It's been exciting and sometimes frustrating at the slow pace of progress, but then leaps and bounds, almost like quantum changes. So if you go back to 2011, no one accepted that you had to have the randomized controlled trial to prove a method worked.
Yeah.
I'd say by 2018, there was an international consensus on that. It hasn't trickled down into like wildlife agency decision making,
okay,
but the scientists around the world seem to be on the same page.
Now, that's really terrific.
Yeah.
Just a couple more questions. One is just a general kind of a wrap up thing. Is there an aspect or aspects of your research or things you found out that you would like to bring to light, but I haven't asked the right question to get to?
Well, you've asked great questions. You know, I could go on at length. I love this topic. You know what we've really, one of the consensus that I think has come from the research is that most conflicts with wildlife are actually political conflicts between different interest groups of people. And what we have in the states, U.S. at the moment in the United States, is a culture war over how policy should be formulated. There's a sort of an old technocratic view that policy is based on science, but that's highly misleading because actually policy stems from values, people's values, right? What they view as a good way to live in the world versus a bad way to live in the world. And what science does is just provide information about the past and the current status and maybe some predictions about what'll happen if you implement a particular policy. But the science doesn't tell you what to do. And unfortunately, that line is being blurred quite often by policymakers in this state and beyond when they try to hide behind the science and say things like, the science tells us we must hunt wolves, for example.
Right.
That's absolute nonsense. It's their values that are telling them that.
Mm-hmm.
And by throwing science at the public, sometimes they cloud the public policy debate because the science can be hard to interpret, right?
Right.
Some of it's models and graphs and mathematical formulae.
Mm-hmm.
So I would just urge policymakers around the country to be transparent when they're speaking from values, especially when their decision seems to contradict a prediction made by scientists, by the scientific community that's come to consensus, taking lethal control of wolves as an example. Several states have taken wolf killing to extremes, like Idaho, Wyoming, Montana, I would say Wisconsin during certain periods, and tried to justify it with scientific evidence, such as we need to protect farm animals. Well, there's no evidence for that. So if they were transparent and said, well, we're going to kill a lot of wolves because we don't like living with wolves, that's a value statement.
Right.
And it's more honest.
Yeah. Yeah. Or because it's just enjoyable to hunt wolves. I mean, again, it's back to that confirmation bias is let's pretend the science supports what I wanted to do anyway.
Exactly. And in independent scientists like my group, we hate that.
Yeah.
Because we feel like policymakers are hiding behind a myth of science.
Good. Thank you for hating it. And thank you for being a force against it because, because I mean, science, you know, it's not it's not an answer, but it's our best way of getting to an answer that is meaningful. And so I'm really, this is one of the things I love about doing this show is I interview scientists and every interview makes me smarter.
Thanks for doing it. You're an incredible ally in getting the word out to the public about how science is done and what it isn't and what it is.
Thanks. Well, it's definitely my pleasure. The last question is, sometimes I just like to get to know, what are you all about? I know you do a lot of traveling. You're very, very busy with your work, but when you're not doing this stuff, do you have hobbies, interests? Do you? I'm guessing you don't hunt wolves.
No.
What do you like to do in your spare time?
Thanks for asking, Buzz. I actually biked over here after playing soccer, so those are two of my big. Big hobbies. I noticed you had a ball out in your front lobby, and I was curious, was that a volleyball? I didn't take a close look.
I believe it is, but it's not mine. Okay. My the hint as to my favorite hobby is my earring. It's a little carabiner. I'm technical rock climbing is my thing, and I enjoy it a lot. It's it's a non-competitive, just beautiful sport that can be done very safely, even though people think of it as a dangerous thing, but that's my thing.
Good for you. I couldn't do it. I have just a little bit of touch of fear of heights that came on with age, and I'll leave the rock climbing to you.
Fair enough. I will do it. So soccer and bicycling.
Yeah.
Terrific.
And birds, some birding, walking my dog.
Oh, some birding. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Do you have a favorite bird to watch and observe in Wisconsin?
Indigo buntings right now are being very vocal, but they're really hard to see. So that's the challenge. Okay. Yeah, that's a cool one. And of course, the cranes are always a treat.
They're I know, right? They're amazing. In my rock climbing, I see lots of sandhill cranes. Yeah. And then one of my other hobbies is kayaking, and I see lots of blue herons near the water. And it's just amazing to come across one just as they're taking off. Yeah. It's this
and
prehistoric thing.
I agree completely. In fact, wild turkeys always remind me of dinosaurs.
Yeah.
But kayaking and canoeing, when you're quiet at that level in the water, it's the best way to watch wildlife.
It really is. Yeah, it really is. I've seen some really, really incredible stuff. Oh my gosh, Adrian Trevis, thank you so much.
Thank you, Buzz.
Your work is fascinating. It's important, and I'm really glad that we had a chance to chat. Thanks for coming in.
My pleasure. I'm grateful.
You've been listening to the Badger Talks podcast. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Dr. Adrian Trevis, professor of environmental studies and the founder and director of the Carnivore Coexistence Lab at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Please browse our previous episodes for other topics that may be of interest to you. The Badger Talks podcast is a creation of UW Connects and produced at Audio for the Arts Recording Studios in Madison, Wisconsin. Our music is composed by Bill Purdy and performed by the UW Marching Band. I'm Buzz Kemper. Thank you for listening.